Hey, everybody, welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com, movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm super excited for this week's show because after 750 odd episodes, we finally decided to talk about Jaws from 1975, which means I'm joined by the man with the blackest eyes, JB.
The what? I literally sweat blood trying to come up with the appropriate quote. It came down to that, or here's to swimming with bull-legged women. So in the spirit of a make-your-own-adventure, here, I'll say it again.
Okay.
Here's to swimming with bull-legged women.
Very
then,
nice.
If you click around, you, the listener, if you click around, you can get me to say whatever you want.
I love it.
Because this film is formidable. And I just finished watching it for, I think, the 50th time. You know, I'm going to go out on a limb. This movie's really good.
Well, this is my concern, because only after, you know, I felt like we needed to first talk about the 19th remake of The Three Musketeers. And then once we got that out of the way, then we could talk about Jaws. But talking about Jaws on a movie podcast is like going on a music podcast to review the Beatles. Like, what do you even say at this point? Or reviewing, you know, Happy Birthday.
I would go on a music podcast and review the Beatles, but that's just me. Thank you, by the way, for the Three Musketeers podcast, because when Jake was of a certain age, we took him to all of those. And I have a very, and I saw some miserable shit. and I have a very warm spot in my heart for films like The Three Musketeers that you and Adam talked about, and Tom and Huck.
Oh, I've never seen that one.
And a whole bunch of Disney live-action films that were released, I'd say, between 92 and 2000. And at least, I mean, they're better than Shazam, and they're certainly better than...
Do you mean Kazam?
I made this mistake last weekend when we were talking. Kazam is Bad Genie.
Right.
Shazam is the Marvel. Wait,
right.
Is he Captain Marvel or not? But the Apple Dumpling Gang, the Boatniks, the Shook Up Shopping Cart. Man, when
hey,
I
that's
was
not a real one.
When I was 12, I was trying to send some of our younger listeners scurrying to IMDb.
I wanted to see the Apple Dumpling Gang so bad when I was a kid because I had been a big fan of The Private Eyes. That was a movie that me and my siblings watched a lot. And
yeah,
so
I
was
that.
like, hey, those two are in another movie together. How can I see this Apple Dumpling Gang? And then it's like mostly a movie about Bill Bixby and some kids he doesn't want.
How did Bill Bixby hook up with those orphans? And Susan Clark's in it. And if you want to go looking for it, loyal listeners, I wrote a column about it because when I was 12 or 13, I used to go to the late lamented Arlington Theater with my best friend Don, and we'd sit in the back of the theater and make fun of the movies. I'm not proud of it, and I'm sure I ruined a lot of people's good times, but Apple Dumpling Gang, you just sit there and you're like, this is miserable. I'm not a sophisticated 12-year-old, but I know that this was made for me.
Yeah.
And no thanks. I'm taking it back to Sears. If this is my birthday present, Walt. In any case, I will say this. I am of an age that when Jaws was released, I saw it in a theater the first weekend.
The and, first and only
and still
time?
Remember, and still remember that screening.
I want to hear all about it. The first and only time I've ever seen Jaws in a theater was for David Lando's birthday, like 2 years ago.
Well, wait, does that mean you were not at the Tivoli screening?
Correct.
Why do I put you there?
I don't know.
The Tivoli showed it one night when the 4K restoration had just been released to theaters, and the staff made a big deal of it, and they dressed up, and there was trivia in the line so you could win stuff. I won something. Because I remember the name of the dog at the beginning of the film.
What's the dog's name?
Well, that would be Pippin, because it was the 70s, and everything was named after Pippin. Because you see, Patrick, jazz hands, we've got magic to do. just for you. We've got miracle plays to play.
I don't know the show Pippin at all.
Well, that's odd because it was written by the guy who wrote Godspell, personal favorite, and went on to do Wicked.
Oh, okay.
Pippin was a very big deal in the 70s. Have you ever heard the song Corner of the Sky?
Nope.
That's the ballad that the film, I'm sorry, that the Broadway show gave us. And it was a famous thing on Broadway because Bob Fosse had choreographed it, directed it. And
I'm
it
familiar with
was a hell of a
Scottie
thing.
Pippen because you once sent me on a journey to retrieve his giant underpants.
I don't remember that right now.
There was a billboard in Chicago of Scottie Pippen holding up a pair of enormous underpants. And I think you wanted to project something on the enormous underpants. And so you were having me call billboard companies to see if we could get said underpants.
Okay, I remember now. Please note, it was for a show we were doing. This isn't something creepy I wanted for my basement.
It's just his kink.
Oh my God.
Hey, J Bones, have you seen anything good lately?
Well, I'll tell you, besides some really cool book signings,
Woohoo!
I've been leaning into repertory lately, and the local theater showed North by Northwest last Tuesday, and it was magnificent. They got a big crowd. That film plays the audience like a violin. And I remember at one point, it's the scene right in front of the United Nations building. I was sitting there and I thought, oh, well, I've seen this 50 times. I can take a minute and say, wait, what about? But then I realized that Hitchcock knew back then that if audiences were thinking that, he had failed.
Right.
And so the first 50 times you watch North by Northwest, you're so taken with the story, you don't ask yourself that question in front of the United Nations building because it doesn't matter. Last night, TCM was wrapping up its MGM month and they showed Pennies from Heaven, the controversial Steve Martin musical. And ages ago, I wrote a column about it for F This Movie because a boutique label had finally put it out on disc. And certainly, if you like Steve Martin or you love musicals, you need to see it because it's so great. I kind of get why it failed back then, but I don't understand why it failed back then. And
it should have found an audience by now. I get why it failed back then, but it should be a movie that everybody's discovering and saying, holy shit. I thought maybe the Steve Martin documentary would turn some people on to it.
Yeah. No one knew who. It's coming. Every bad comedian does an impression of him, though.
Huh?
Deer Hunter.
Christopher Walken?
This movie was made before anyone knew who Christopher Walken was, and certainly didn't realize that he got his start on Broadway as a hoofer. So I'd say his number is the best number in the film. It's amazing, both for how he dances it and how it's choreographed. But there's one about halfway through that's just technically amazing. The front of a diner gives away, and suddenly it's literally raining coins because it's the title number. And this amazing dancer dances in the rain, and they're using special effects. I think I could put my finger on. They filmed it sped up with the music sped up and the dancer appropriately fast, and then they slowed it down. So it's in slow motion, but the music is playing at the correct speed, and it's just the most amazing thing you'll ever see. So last night, I'm watching it for probably the 10th time, and I haven't been able to look it up yet, but someone messed with the ending of that film. I'm pretty sure it's not the ending of the BBC miniseries that it came from. But if you watch the last 10 minutes of Pennies from Heaven, this was cobbled together, and this is not the way it originally ended. This is some sort of studio director compromise, which sucks because it's amazing. And if our listeners were not aware, Columbia is showing all the live-action Spider-Man films in theaters over the next couple weeks. And last night, the night before last, if you're listening to this on Wednesday, they
Got it.
got Spider-Man 3. So if you're a Tobey Maguire fan, you're out of luck. But if you want to see the other ones, they're coming every Monday. And I went to see Spider-Man 2 because it's so good. And wow, here's a rarity. The theater sold out.
That's awesome.
And it was on one of the bigger screens. So I'm beginning to wonder if post-COVID going to the movies is becoming like vinyl collecting, a boutique hobby for people who are a little bit older than what the main audience for movies. I mean, movies used to be kids and teenagers. That
Right.
was the biggest part of the audience. And now they steal their parents' Netflix passwords and they don't have to pay 10 bucks for popcorn.
I saw somebody tweet out, and I wish I could give them credit, but I don't remember who it was, talking about the box office, like both Alien, which was re-released this weekend, and Spider-Man 3 made about $1 million in their respective like one day releases.
Said the
And
studio, found money.
That was exactly this person's point. It was like they were framing it as a sort of a dagger in the heart of Fathom Events, because now studios can just re-release their own stuff and find money by doing it. And so we may be entering a new age of sort of widespread repertory cinema.
Where every theater becomes a repertory theater,
Yeah.
because, of course, if you haven't heard, The Mummy is also getting a
That was
theatrical
another one.
release
Yeah.
this week.
Yeah.
And this is a years ago, Mike Pomero famously said on the podcast, if someone had told me when I was a kid that every week there'd be a comic book movie, and my reaction as an adult would be enough already, I would have said you're joking. But back when multi-screens, back when what were they called? Theaters with many screens.
Cineplexes,
Yes, that's the word. That's the magic word. Back when multiplexes first became a thing, which I was also alive to witness, I screamed for over a decade. You got 10 screens. Can you devote two of them to older films?
just
And
one.
now, thanks to COVID and the disinterest of young people, go young people. We only care about Palestine. My wish is coming true.
Yeah.
Makes me happy because I did not go to Spider-Man 3 last night, but I did check my little Flixster app and it sold out.
Wow. That makes me happy, because when the Tom Holland Spider-Mans started coming out, it became sort of fashionable for people to shit on the Raimis. And it's
Yeah.
like, we don't have to hate the old thing just because the new thing is shiny and maybe we like it. The
No,
Raimi
not at
movies,
all.
I have issues with Spider-Man 3, but the Raimi movies are really good.
And oh, what's the word I'm looking for? Genuine and heartfelt and sincere.
Yeah.
I like the sincerity of them. They're not ironic nostalgia jaunts. I haven't seen part one in a long time, but I was really impressed with the extent to which Spider-Man 2 holds up.
I think it's still the high watermark of superhero cinema. I think it's the best one of those that's ever been made.
Especially Alfred Molina's performance, which choosing him was a really great idea, because,
Yeah.
man.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Anything else, or is that it?
That's it.
Okay. I've got just a couple that I can talk about
You just have a
before.
night's worth of entertainment.
A lot of what I've been watching has been to write about, because I write a lot of list articles, and every time I do, I end up having to watch 10 to 12 movies. But before I left, I did pull out my still shrink-wrapped Blu-ray of Ingmar Bergman's Persona
Oh,
and
wow.
watched that for the first time because
And what made you do that?
I'm very deficient in Bergman. And I was showing a class the first of three parts of A Decade Under the Influence, because we're talking about 70s cinema. And all these great 70s directors rattle off all of their European influences. And I thought to myself, I haven't seen enough Fellini. I haven't seen enough, what's his name, who did the Renoir. I haven't seen enough Bergman. So I took Persona off the shelf. And obviously, I need to sit with it for longer. I probably need to watch it seven more times before I even totally understand it. But it was fascinating to ride this line between this is striking and kind of brilliant and blowing my mind. And on the other side, it plays almost like a parody of what you think a Bergman movie is.
Because it's become so established what that is, and so many people, especially. Well, Woody Allen was one of them, but he's not alone. That it's been ingested by the culture, and it's very hard to approach it clear and safe and
Right.
just with new eyes.
If you are, doing a parody of a student film to show like a film student as sort of a pretentious douche, what you do is rip off Bergman.
Yeah.
And so Persona at times felt like that, but obviously I can't hold him accountable for decades of imitators. I thought it was pretty incredible, but like I said, I won't imply that I have my head wrapped all the way around it yet.
I saw that for the first time in college. I think I was 19, and we were much closer to when it was actually made. So it did not suffer from
Right.
everyone on earth has ripped this off and made fun of it. And I still remember that Thursday night. It just fucking blew me away.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, there's every film I've ever watched in my life from America. And then there's this guy saying, oh, no, you could do this.
Right. And this was like the second, maybe only the second Bergman movie I've seen. And the first one I saw was Smiles of a Summer Night, which is just like this little lark. It's nothing like the Bergman that we now know. And this, I feel like, is Bergman on steroids, if I'm understanding him correctly as a filmmaker.
Yes, my high school humanities teacher, God bless her, showed a Seventh Seal.
Oh, I have seen that too. So I've seen three.
And I will maintain, I haven't seen it in a really long time, but I think I was 16. And at the time, I thought it was one of the scariest films I had ever seen. And
Yeah.
not just because he's playing chess with death, I thought it was really, really frightening.
Yeah. I just remembered I have seen another one too, because I've seen The Virgin Spring.
Yes, and I know why you've seen The Virgin Spring because
Right.
it's the original version of Last House on the Left.
Exactly. I think I watched that in the lead up to our Craven Craven episode on Last House on the Left, which was also when I watched that movie Chaos, which is like a ripoff of Last House on the Left and one of the worst movies I've ever seen.
I vaguely remember seeing that.
Ebert was
I'm
in
at
a
an
real
age
battle
now
with the
where
filmmakers.
I've been forgetting awful, stupid, boring stuff. So
Good.
all that's left, all the flotsam and jetsam that floats to the top is, oh, I went to a book signing Saturday by one of my friends and former students, and it was delightful.
Robert Altman
And
in
I was
that.
so proud of him.
Oh, thank you. We'll talk about that in one sec. Robert Altman in that documentary says, I don't remember the name of the filmmakers who influenced me the most because I would see something and I would hate it, and I would think, well, I'm never going to do that. But he didn't commit their names to memory, which I think is interesting. So hopefully that's the point that we're at. We're only remembering the good stuff.
Also smart because life's too short.
Right. So Saturday, I was in Los Angeles. I had a book signing. JB was there. Doug was there. Erica was there.
It was something.
Heather was there, obviously, because she wrote the book with me. And it was fun and it was cool. And there were a lot of 80s horror celebs in attendance to sign the book with us, which was very cool and somewhat humbling. And then I left from there and went straight to the New Beverly because they were doing their secret 80s Sony-thon, which was four movies that were not announced in advance. You just knew that they were from the 80s and they were released by Columbia Pictures because all month long they were celebrating 100 years of Columbia.
So Elric and Rupert had a tie, literally tie Patrick to the chair, because on a previous occasion, Patrick has said he's not sure if he could ever go to anything like that.
I remember talking about it on a podcast probably 12 years ago in your basement.
That's right.
And you were describing this phenomenon to me where it's like, you don't know what they're going to show. And then they just show something. And I was like, oh, I could never do that. I could never handle that. And
I still remember the conversation really well.
surely this means that all my anxiety meds are working because I was open to the idea. So we sat down and everybody plays this guessing game based on all the trailers. And me and Brian and Elric were in a long text thread trying to guess what they were going to show. And a lot of those got knocked out right away because, like, the first trailer they show was for Blue Thunder. And we were sure that was going to be one of the movies. So it was like, well, fuck, that's out. Okay. The first movie instead was Out of Bounds, starring Anthony Michael Hall and Jenny Wright. Where he plays a farm boy from Iowa who moves to the big city, Los Angeles, and accidentally winds up with a suitcase full of smack, and criminals come after him, and only Jenny Wright can help him. And it's the kind of movie that, like, you remember watching on cable. It's Anthony Michael Hall very much trying to do something different and shed his, like, Farmer Ted from 16 Candles image, where he's
They're
just
almost almost trying to emphasize how tall he's become
right.
by making him a basketball player.
He's gotta butch it up a little bit, so he's starring in this action drama. It played like gangbusters. It's very entertaining. Is it a good movie? I don't know. It doesn't matter. It was a real crowd pleaser. So that was fun, and I was sure I had seen it before, but about 15 minutes in, I was like, no, I've never seen this. So that was kind of cool to watch. It was the only of the one of the four movies that I had never seen any of.
Well,
And that
it's worth
was,
seeing because it has Jenny Wright in it.
well, of course. And she's playing a real almost like a Madonna type character. She wants to be an actress, and she's very over the top. The next movie was Pulse from 1988, which used to play on HBO all the time because it's a PG movie. It's the rare leading man role for Cliff DeYoung, an actor I really like. And I believe the big screen debut of one Joey Lawrence, who plays his son, who comes out to, again, Los Angeles to spend a summer because his parents are divorced. And suddenly weird phenomenon start happening with the electricity in the house, and we eventually learn that the electricity is cursed or some shit, and it's trying to kill them.
So you're saying it's a sequel to Wes Craven's Shocker?
Basically, it's pretty well made. Like, I was surprised at the filmmaking. It's a little slower and less crowd-pleasy than Out of Bounds, but still cool, to see in a theater a movie I'd only ever seen on cable and on 35 millimeter. And all of these prints, by the way, you would swear had never screened. They were all pristine.
Very jealous of that.
It's cool because every once in a while you have to pinch yourself because you forget. You just get sucked into the movie. And then you have to take a step back and say, wait, I'm watching a 35 millimeter print a fucking Out of Bounds, you know, a movie that probably played a week in 1986 and then has been in a vault since then.
Oh, that's why there's no scratches.
Exactly. It's not like a 35 millimeter print of Raiders of the Lost Ark, which has been trotted out for 40 years, you know. That was followed up by the biggest success of the night, which we called right away because we noticed there's little intermissions between the movies. And the music changed. Before Pulse, it had been the score to The Terminator. And I noticed that right after Pulse, they were playing a song by The Cars, Shake It Up. And I thought nothing of it. Shake It Up's a good song. But then the next song was The Police's De-Doo-Doo-Doo-De-Da-Da-Da. And I put it together that this is the soundtrack to The Last American Virgin, which can only mean the next movie is going to be a sex comedy. And all the trailers start, and they're all for sex comedies. And then Hard Bodies unspools before us. And I had seen Hard Bodies because I once reviewed it for DVD Verdict.
And is Hard Bodies the one with Tim Robbins?
No, that would be Fraternity Vacation.
My bad.
Hard Bodies stars, shit, what's his name? Graham. He's in Killer Clowns from Outer Space, speaking of the Kyoto brothers. It came out in 1984. It stars Grant Kramer as a surfer who is hired by three older gentlemen to show them how to pick up girls on the beach. It is an incredibly horny movie. Everyone is naked. The jokes are somehow beneath lowbrow, and it blew the doors off at the New Beverly. And go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just putting this together that because they were still celebrating Sony / Columbia. All the films were Columbia.
Yeah.
I once worked at Columbia Pictures video cassettes.
Right.
And Hard Bodies was one of our least popular titles. There were hundreds of copies on the shelf in the warehouse with, it was comical. It was like a Disney short. There were cobwebs on them and dust, and no one wanted to go there.
That's surprising because
put that together.
To me, it seems like the kind of movie that's made for home video and cable television. Because as we were watching it, I was thinking about how well it plays to an educated audience 40 years after the fact. But in 1984, if you went to see Hard Bodies opening day in like some fucking mall theater, you would have been one of three people.
Yes.
The jokes would have all died and you would have just felt skeezy because people are constantly getting naked. And it was like when Erica and Doug and I went to see an adult film in 3D at the Music Box once, where we were like, this will be funny. And then 5 minutes later, you're like, oh, the joke's over. Now we're just watching a porn with a lot of single men. Hard Bodies in the theater would be like that. But I would think people would rent it because this was how you saw nudity back in 1984.
This was so early in the home video revolution. Our top title was Brian Song.
Wow. Okay.
Because, you know, that was heart-tugging. Plus, when I worked there, it was only, what year did you say Hard Bodies came out?
84.
Okay, so I'm working at this place. Oh, like the year after it came out in theaters.
Okay.
Okay.
It seems like a movie that...
Interrupting you, this is like a nostalgic stew for me.
It seems like a movie that never played theaters. It seems like it just suddenly appeared on VHS one day.
It wasn't released. It escaped.
Exactly. But it was so much fun to watch. And then it capped things off with, again, a bunch of like coming of age, semi-action-y trailers. We got like Karate Kid 2 and Stand By Me. And all the trailers are 35 millimeter. I mean, it's so fucking cool. I really recommend everybody who has the means to attend one of these. And then after the trailers, the masking on either side of the screen opened up a little bit to 2, 3, 5. And the whole audience went, Oh, like we were so excited. And I was like, these are my people. We are dorks who are excited because we're going to watch something in scope. And Whitewater Summer unspools, starring Sean Astin and Kevin Bacon in the first of his Whitewater Guides from Hell roles.
Yes.
It was shot by Stanley Kubrick's guy.
I like Kevin Bacon when he's wet.
Kevin Bacon is great. The photography is amazing. It's actual nature. It's beautifully shot. There are sequences that are incredibly harrowing, like they're trying to cross this skinny little bridge, which was reminding me of Sorcerer. Sean Astin is dangling from a mountain for 15 minutes at one point. But there's this weird choice where they got all the footage back and someone decided this isn't working. So what if we got Sean Astin back, stick him in a Hawaiian shirt, and have him talk to the camera Ferris Bueller style? Ugh. Let me tell you about this summer I had. Except 2 years had gone by and he had gone through puberty, so he's significantly older in these Ferris Bueller segments. The editing is bizarre.
It's,
I mean,
looking back on his youth in the in the Hawaiian shirt.
It feels like a weirdly unfinished movie, but it was still very entertaining. I have no complaints.
Your experience in the theater when Road Warrior was first released to theaters, the prologue is in 1:1:3.
Yes.
And then there's that famous sound effect and shot of the car. And if you saw in a theater, the curtains open and it goes to 1:2:35. And it was magnificent. Even people in the theater who had no idea what, everyone just thought it, that was the coolest thing they'd ever seen. They should bring that back.
They do it a little bit now. I mean, there's no such thing as masking anymore.
Or
everything is right exactly. But sometimes there's movies that some sequences are shot for IMAX, so the aspect ratio will change. I remember seeing a Transformers movie where like only certain shots were in IMAX format, and it's a Michael Bay movie, so shots last 1.5 seconds. And the aspect ratio just kept switching back and forth. It was
jarring. Having a stroke.
Yes, it was not a fun experience.
Was your 80s thon at the New Bev sold out?
It was.
Excuse me. Almost all those special things sell out very
pretty
quickly.
I think, yeah.
It is my dream, though. One day I will get there. And apparently my son's been telling me about the programming at the Vista, the second theater that Quentin Tarantino bought. So between the two, I'll get there.
They used to do like one of these a year, I think, one of these secret marathons. They would do one in October. It seems like they're doing one a month now. I know the
Didn't
one in
used
May.
To do something similar to the Music Box Massacre too, although not always in October.
I mean, they did an all-nighter, but I don't think it was a 24-hour thing.
But it was all horror.
It was all horror. They still do that in October. And there's one coming up in May that's all Italian horror.
So
yeah.
Those of you attending that, let me give you some advice. What you want to do is you want to go for the first 15 minutes of every film, and then you can take the next hour off. And then scoot back in for the last 15 minutes, a lather, rinse, repeat. Because something I've noticed about giallo films is that the very beginning and the very end seem to have been labored over and directed by the masters, and then it's handed off to someone else to fill in the middle. I don't know if I'm alone in this, but this is something I've noticed about giallo.
I'm to the point now where they're like slashers for me. I can just watch any of them and kind of enjoy it's their comfort food for me.
Not at that point yet, but I will admit I haven't closed off my mind to all of them. When you get a good one,
yeah,
it's something. It's
yeah.
just It's, you know what it's a lot like? It's a lot like film noir. So many of them were made in such a short time. There's a lot of ground to cover,
Yeah.
and they vary wildly in quality.
It's always a weird phenomenon when I watch an old black and white film that isn't very good. Because in my brain, it's like, well, this came out when movies were great. And so everything old is automatically good, right? And then I'm like, oh no, they used to make shit too. And this is one of those.
That is the Turner Classic Movies phenomenon, that the stuff that gets shown the most are the bright, shining examples
Right.
on a hill. And people think that the garbage floats to the bottom. Wait, floating to the bottom makes no sense. You get what I'm saying.
Speaking of floating, let's talk about Jaws.
Yeah. So you said, what year did this thing come out?
75.
Okay, so I am 13
Okay.
and I go see it by myself because no one would go to the movies with me back then because I'm in eighth grade and I want to go see Small Change because it made the Mount Prospect 1 and 2.
I just
It's
watched them.
Francois Truffaut, I
Yeah.
yell, and my parents pat me on the head and my father drives me there. So I remember I had never seen a film that had played an audience like that in my life. People just lost their shit. And there was a sneaking suspicion, and I was a fairly sophisticated 13-year-old, that I was watching something that I was not yet ready for, or something that I should not have been seeing because the rating back then was PG. Parents strongly cautioned because PG-13 didn't exist. Well, my parents weren't there to be cautioned, and it just scared the shit out of me.
I mean, except for the head floating, there's nothing in the movie that shouldn't be PG, or, unless you count like overall intensity.
Well, I'm trying to place myself back then, and I think you're right, which has been a litany of complaint against the MPAA. That frequently they're rating the intent rather than what's on the screen. So, in essence, why do you have a problem with this film? Well, the answer is because the filmmaker was so successful, it's too intense for children. There isn't snip this, snip that, snip this. It's the overarching effect of the whole thing, which is going to give you nightmares. But thankfully, the film is about sharks. And I was smart enough to know that I lived in Illinois and there weren't no sharks in Lake Michigan. So this stuff did not become nightmare fuel because I was like, oh, I'm safe. I don't live on the ocean.
So you weren't one of these weirdos because you get talking heads all the time in every horror documentary talking about the first time they saw Jaws, and every one of them will talk about, I was so scared when I got home that there were going to be sharks in my bathtub, and I'm like, you sound like a dummy.
This reminds me of the stand-up comedian who took to task people who took acid and then jumped from a building thinking they could fly. Well, if you thought you could fly, why didn't you start from the ground? Why didn't you get a running start on the ground? So basically what we're saying is we lost a dummy.
Right.
We lost
RIP.
another doorknob.
RIP, dummies.
So, one of my favorite stories, because I'm so old now, I go to Universal Studios and I go on the tram tour and I secretly judge the tour guide where a week or two ago there was an accident on the tram tour. And I'm not, please, no, I'm not making fun of the accident. What happened was tragic and I'm not making fun of it. But the accident got national news exposure. So a bunch of my friends who don't live in California found out about it. And one of my friends, who too was not making fun of the accident, sent me a text saying the tram driver was distracted because a portly man in the front row kept muttering about he could do a better job than the tour guide. And that's what led to the accident. So here's my favorite tram story of all time. When Jaws was finished, they dragged the orca to Universal Studios Hollywood and they put it in the lagoon where they used to film Murder, She Wrote. And they used to talk all the time about the sea shanty town in the back lot was used for Murder, She Wrote in the 9,000 episodes of that thing they did. And I noticed lately they don't mention Murder, She Wrote anymore. I think because no one who's on the tram remembers that as a TV show. So it would just leave them scratching their heads. So if you were taking the Universal Tram Tour in the mid-70s and you, spoiler alert, get to the Jaws portion, one of the things in the lagoon was the orca, the real boat from the movie. That's where they took it, which is so cool. When Spielberg was working on the lot, he said he would often walk down there with his lunch and sit in the boat and have lunch. Can you imagine going on the tram tour? Hey, there's someone in that boat. Oh, Jesus, it's Steven Spielberg. Steven, get out of the boat. There's a shark.
I'm
So the
surprised he didn't
boat.
have PTSD from shooting the movie, that he would be able to sit in the boat still.
The boat was there for decades. It fell into horrible disrepair. And then, unbeknownst to Steven, they dragged it out of the lagoon and threw it away.
While he was in it, which explains the Lost World.
And when I think about how he must have felt about that, I'm guessing some heads rolled at Universal because clearly he would have paid to have it restored. It would be the Ruby Slippers. It would be the Rosebud Sled. My God, you still have the boat? But that's a true story.
I like it. This is one of those movies that's hard to talk about. I kind of wish you were doing this podcast with Erica instead of me, because she teaches this movie every semester and knows lots of things about it that I don't know.
And do young people still respond to it?
They do. She says her students get really into it and talk back to the screen and jump. She often will film just before Richard Dreyfuss finds the head. She'll film the back of her audience and watch them all jump as the head pops out.
Some syndicated television show. It wasn't AFI, Scariest Movies. It wasn't BFI. It was something else. There was a syndicated television show of the 100 scariest moments that made the rounds one Halloween, and they named The Head in the Boat as the number one movie scare of all time.
It's a good jump scare. I've heard people name, "Why don't you come down here and chum some of this shit?" And Jaws pops out of the water because it's the first time we really get a look at the shark. But I don't think that's scary or even a good jump scare. But maybe that's because I've seen this movie enough times. I just think it's funny because
Well,
of the timing
yeah.
of it and Roy Scheider's reaction.
And Spielberg is on record as saying that back in the 70s, you knew you could get a laugh if you used the word shit. And it was his intention to turn the laugh into a scream. And so that's the engine that drives that. It makes me happy that young people are still watching it because, again, I just finished it about a half an hour ago. And I was blown away by it. Ebert once said that a great film has three great scenes and no bad scenes. Would you agree? The three great scenes in Jaws are the opening 10 minutes, which I used to use in my film study class as an example of montage editing, aka you see the girl, you see the shark, actually, you don't see the shark. But you never, it's just a masterpiece of editing. The Ben Gardner scene, for obvious reasons. And then I would argue Robert Shaw's monologue. And I noticed something this time because Doug Pratt, who used to edit the Laserdisc DVD Blu-ray newsletter,
I used to love that.
I don't know if it still exists. If it does, I need to resubscribe. Because you had to flip Laserdiscs over after an hour, he had lots of theories about how narrative films are laid out. And one thing I did notice earlier today, obviously the opening of the film is at the opening of the film. The Ben Gardner moment is almost exactly halfway through. And I'm thinking that's not an accident. And then halfway through the film, and then the Shaw monologue about the USS Indianapolis is an hour and a half in of a 2-hour film. So I didn't have time, but I'm guessing something really famous happens at the half an hour mark because you see how this film is laid out very stealthily.
Half an hour might be Alex Kittner, although that's sooner in the movie than I realized. Watching it today, I was like, oh, for some reason, I thought there was a larger gap between the girl at the beginning and Alex Kittner, but they're pretty close together. Like, we're introduced to Roy Scheider, and before you know it, he's sitting on the beach watching that all go down.
We know about you, Sheriff. You don't like to go in the water. I was watching it again today and I was struck by, and this might have something to do with the 70s versus the 2020s, that it's a very sincere film that takes death seriously, that death has meaning. And I'm watching the film, and obviously we feel for Chrissy at the beginning, and the scene with Alex Kittner's mother is justifiably famous when she confronts Roy Scheider. This is a film where death has meaning. And I know I've always said, and this isn't original to me, but in Westerns, you can tell who's a bad guy and who's a good guy because to the good guys, death has meaning, and to the bad guys, death has no meaning whatsoever. But I was sitting watching Jaws and I was just comparing it to films where either death has no meaning, or it's used as a punchline, or we see thousands of people killed and it's part of the special effects. Maybe it shows that I'm getting very sentimental in my old age, but I really appreciated how much respect this film had for humanity and for the reality of what the characters are going through.
Well, I mean, I would argue that this is a ha one of a handful of what we would refer to as perfect movies.
Yes.
And I think I would make a case that Steven Spielberg has a handful of perfect movies, but I think this is the only one that's both perfect and flawless, and that distinction makes sense in my head. I think Jurassic Park is a pretty perfect movie, but it has flaws, and that's okay because that doesn't mean it's not perfect. But Jaws is really like the titular shark, this insane mechanism.
Perfect movie machine.
It is. It's this insane entertainment mechanism.
It moves forward, it entertains you, and it never stops.
But it's not, this we could talk about this, but like this movie a lot of times gets credit, this and Star Wars get credit for killing the 1970s because they invented the blockbuster and then studios learned all the wrong lessons and they just started chasing Jaws and
Right,
Star Wars.
but then blame the chasing films, not
100%.
these two superior pieces of work. So again, I keep prefacing every comment with a couple hours ago, but my most recent viewing, I'm sitting there and I'm like, well, he did two Night Gallery episodes and a Columbo and then the Sugar Land Express.
And
This
duel.
film is. Oh, I knew there was one more.
Yeah.
This is remarkably accomplished
He was in his 20s when he made this movie.
for one so early in their career. And for those of you with Peacock as a streaming service, do some canoodling with your thumbs on the remote. There is a hilarious Columbo episode where one of the suspects is Fisher Stevens, and clearly he's Steven Spielberg. Columbo is a Universal property. They filmed it on the lot. It is hilarious and unintentionally hilarious. But if you like Columbo and love Steven Spielberg, clearly, as in some of those Scooby-Doo made for TV movies, you want to see Columbo meet Steven Spielberg, check it out. It's on Peacock.
I know there are a lot of people. Oh, so what I was going to say is like, this isn't, even though it's this perfect entertainment machine, it's not what I think people describe as a thrill ride or a roller coaster. Something like Raiders of the Lost Ark, which I would argue is also a pretty perfect entertainment machine, is much more of a roller coaster. Jaws is not lacking in substance.
Maybe part of that is because it is based on a book, and we can talk about the famous things that they left out of the book. But because it wasn't designed to be a thrill ride, whereas Raiders was these two gentlemen trying to recapture movie serials and amp them up, that because it's got this literary background, we actually have characters that makes sense and characters that we can care about. Speaking of characters, here's one thing I can bring to the Jaws party that I've never seen discussed. This is going to seem like a crazy tangent. It's not. The other night, Turner Classic Movies showed Lenny, the Bob Fosse biopic of Lenny Bruce, and it stars Dustin Hoffman. About 2 years ago, my wife and I went to a one-man show in Chicago that was the actor in question, and they had this show in a bar. It was a real bar, and the premise was you were in a nightclub seeing Lenny Bruce. That was the setup. And it was fantastic. And we had to be out of the house because the real estate agent was showing our house. So this was fun. And after the show, the actor who played Lenny Bruce did a Q&A, which was very fascinating, and someone asked him about the Bob Fosse film. And he said something fascinating that stuck in my head, and now I apply it to everything I see. He said Dustin Hoffman was fantastically miscast because in the words of this actor, and I wish I could remember his name, I should look it up, because he was too good. He said there are two types of actors. There are actors who desperately need your approval and love. And then there are actors who don't give a shit about what you think about them. I tend to favor the latter kind of actor, but dig it. He played Lenny Bruce the way one should, the way the young man did on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, because Lenny Bruce didn't give a shit what you thought about him. He had other things on his mind, like comedy and heroin. He was not seeking your love and approval. Dustin Hoffman, and I don't say this as an insult, desperately wants you to love him. That is the type of actor he is. So you see where this is going. And that's why I think the movie Heat works so well, because De Niro doesn't give a shit what you think about him. He's going to give this performance and play the character correctly. And then he's up against Pacino. Again, no insult. Pacino desperately wants your love and approval. So I'm watching Jaws this afternoon. And I think one of the reasons it works, besides the fact that the performance is all the way down the line, there is not one bad performance in Jaws, is that besides the dichotomy between street smarts with Quint and book learning with Hooper, Spielberg gives us actors who embody this Lenny Bruce thing. Robert Shaw could give a shit what you think of him. He often played villains. He's superb. He was also a playwright. Quint is the genuine article. And Richard Dreyfuss is an actor who desperately wants your love and approval. That dichotomy keeps playing out in the film in various ways, and it enriches the text. And then you have Roy Scheider standing there, who's sort of in between. I'm not quite sure how to classify Roy Scheider, but I know this, and this gets back to the book. In the book, it's a big deal that Scheider is what young people today would call a cuck. And through the adventure of the film, he regains his manhood. That his fear of the water is somehow shown to be less than manly, although I would argue Scheider makes that something in the movie Jaws that just makes sense. The famous line, what do they call it? Drowning. That by taking out the chapter where Hooper sleeps with his wife, you remove that impediment by letting Richard Dreyfuss live. Spoiler alert, which he does not in the book. That goes a long way. And so I think Spielberg was smart to make it a little bit more subtle and a little bit less like an Ernest Hemingway story that Scheider is not fully a man and he's going to regain his manhood. Although the film does exist as an amazing critique of American masculinity. Again, every time I watch the movie, I'm so struck. The scene where they think they're doomed and Quint passes out the life jackets and refuses to wear one himself. And then you notice he's wearing his uniform jacket from World War II. And that clearly he's trying to play out a moment from his past. And I don't know. I'm not a psychologist. Is he trying to redo it so that it comes out okay? It did come out okay. He lived. It seems like he's trying to relive it because he has survivor's guilt.
Yeah, that would be my guess. I wouldn't argue that Quint has a death wish, but I definitely think there's a part of him that thinks he was supposed to have drowned that day.
And of course, as far as I know, because Shaw wrote the monologue himself with a little help from a couple other people, that the U.S. Indianapolis thing is either not in the novel or it's downplayed.
Right. Didn't John Milius help with that, too?
I believe he did. If you look into John Milius's curriculum vitae, he had his fingers in a lot of interesting scripts. It's like Robert Towne, who actually wrote the famous Senator Corleone, Governor Corleone speech in the original Godfather.
Did you ever see the John Milius documentary?
Yeah.
It's really good.
Yeah. I've always, I would like to see It's a Mad, 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 Mad World with Edie Adams and Ernie Kovacs in the one car and Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland in the other car, you know, this film that'll never exist. I would love to see the Apocalypse Now that Milius made. I would love to see a version of it.
If Robert Shaw didn't exist, would Steven Spielberg had to have invented him for Jaws?
Well, again, I'm sure you can find on some website other people who were considered for the roles, because that's rife now on movie websites. Oh, look who was considered. But Shaw's amazing, and given that the character he's playing is broad, there's actually subtlety to it, because a couple of weeks ago, the repertory screening at that theater was The Sting. And he's the heavy in The Sting. And his Doyle Lonigan is night and day from Quint. It's two completely different people who are odious in two different ways. You really see how astute Spielberg is, because if you get any of the special editions with deleted scenes, Quint was supposed to be introduced earlier in the film buying piano wire. I guess because piano wire is one of the guns in the drawer in this film, along with the oxygen tanks. And it was so smart to leave that out, because when his nails are on the chalkboard, I mean, that's that's one of the greatest movie entrances of all time. Y'all know me, know how I make my living. God.
And that's what you get when you hire Steven Spielberg, right? Is you get every choice that feels like he couldn't have made a better choice.
Yeah, I'm watching Jaws and I'm thinking about one of my favorite Walt Disney stories. When they were building Disneyland, they showed Walt an early version of Pirates of the Caribbean that had one flume segment. And that was necessary because just like Haunted Mansion, you have to get people from one building to the next. And they showed it to him and it wasn't finished. It was very, very rough. And Disney had one suggestion. He said, why don't we make it two shorter flumes separated? Because after the first one, people won't expect the second one. And that's what you're paying for.
Right.
Because there are people who know what they're doing who have good ideas.
I don't want to get off on too much of a Spielberg tangent, even though we are talking about Jaws, but like, I know there's a lot of people who don't care for Steven Spielberg, and that's fine because there are people who also don't like the way the pizza tastes, and like, who am I to be in their brains, right? But I went through a period, I'm sure, in my early 20s where I was a little bit too cool for school. And I think everyone who loves movies goes through this period where you
Where
start,
you
re
dis where you dismiss him.
you reject the things that are popular because you've just seen your first Tarantino movie and that sends you down a rabbit hole and you don't have time for populist shit like Jurassic Park and Steven Spielberg. And I've always liked Jurassic Park. I'm not saying that I dismiss that, but he makes it seem so easy. And his films are often so nakedly sincere that if all you're chasing is ironic detachment, you reject Steven Spielberg. And in my early
And
20s, I was like, ah, Spielberg, he's not one of my guys.
he has no interest in ironic detachment. But
No.
we've talked about this before. The films he's made in the last 15 years are so good that people don't see how good they are, either because they watch too much junk or because he's established a bar and we've just come to expect. I mean, sit down and watch Bridge of Spies. It's kind of amazing.
If anybody else made Bridge of Spies, it would have been nominated for lots of Oscars. And I mean, I know it was still nominated for some, but.
And I'm confusing it with the Ron Howard film, but the film where Tom Hanks plays Ben Bradley.
The Post.
Right, because I keep calling it The Paper.
Right.
The Post is a superior piece of entertainment. That if you want any irony at all in your entertainment, it's clear that Spielberg made that in the moment of history it was made because he was trying to talk about what was going on in America a few years ago. I will leave it at that.
He's so fucking good. And the older I get and the more movies I see, the more I sit down to watch a Spielberg movie, and I'm just blown away at his blocking, at his casting choices, at his ability to communicate story and character through just visuals. You know,
Yeah.
he's not a guy who's 100% reliant on exposition. That's what movies are supposed to be. They're supposed to be images and sound, and the fact that you have dialogue and exposition is sort of dressing, but like Spielberg could make a silent movie and it would work just as well as one of his sound movies. Jaws has the advantage, I think, of not only being, you know, expertly communicated visually. Again, just look at that opening segment, just like you were just saying, in terms of it being one of the best scenes in the movie, where there's essentially no dialogue and yet we're told a whole story. But Jaws has great dialogue, and you and I have often lamented the fact that dialogue seems to be a mostly forgotten art form in contemporary movies, that we've decided it's not important that the characters be witty and clever, or express themselves in an interesting way. We just have to move the story along.
And that's such a mistake because as a human being, I need to express myself in a entertaining way. And how am I going to do that if A, I don't have an example set by the movies, or B, I don't have movies giving me lines that I can actually use in my life. Again, before I said it might just be that I'm getting older and sentimental, but you had talked about sort of the anti-ironic stance. And earlier today, I'm watching the scene on the beach where Brody approaches the remains of Chrissy. And obviously, I don't know if this is from the book or if it was in the script or if it was Spielberg's idea, but before we get to the remains, Brody's deputy has gotten there first, and he's sitting there with his back to them because he cannot look at them, and he's crying. And it's so moving. It's so incredibly moving because, A, you would think, well, a deputy sheriff sees all sorts of things. But like you said, Spielberg is making the point completely visually that no, this is a sleepy little vacation town. And this is not a hard-edged film noir detective. It's this honest deputy guy who isn't prepared for this, as is the whole island. No one on the island is prepared for this. But that one little touch is repeated throughout the film. It's a film of details. And let Polly do the printing. Well, what about let Polly do the printing?
It's also that phenomenon of that Stephen King talks about of the monster behind the door, because of advancements in makeup effects and special effects. If Jaws were to come out in 2024, we would get a cutaway to Chrissy's body so we could see just how fucked up it is. And we could understand what has horrified everyone who's looking at it. But Spielberg understands, no, we don't need to. The monster's behind the door. We just see them react, and it's going to be 10 times worse than anything I can show.
And he does it twice because later, when Hooper looks over the remains, he plays the exact same game. To the extent that when the coroner takes that little bin out of the vault, we can't believe how small it is. It's really unsettling.
To answer your question from earlier, I think Roy Scheider is the first type of actor. I think he's a guy who doesn't really give a shit what you think about him. I think he's just been cast as the sympathetic hero of this movie. And I think that tension is what makes his character and his performance so interesting, in that we do like Chief
Right, but
Brody.
usually that part is played by a love seeker.
Think
I
about,
was
oh, go
thinking
ahead.
about his whole career, and the only love me part I could find was All That Jazz.
And even that, he's playing a bastard. Like, he
Yeah.
plays a lot of bastards, you know, Sorcerer, he's a bastard. 52 Pickup, he's a bastard, even though he's the lead of that movie.
The
All That Jazz, he's a
Rainmaker,
bastard.
The
The Rainmaker, he's a
Rainmaker,
total bad.
man.
He's an outright villain. Did you ever see that great movie, Cohen and Tate, it's called, the Eric Red movie? It's him and Adam Baldwin.
I've read about it, I've never seen it.
It's really good. Total bastard in that movie. Not a prick. James Woods plays pricks. Roy Scheider
That's
is a bastard. And there's a difference.
funny.
But Chief Brody is not a bastard, you know? And
No.
so that, like, Roy Scheider's another one of those guys that as a kid I took for granted. I just was like, I don't know, he's somebody that my parents like. And then the older I get, the more I'm like, Roy Scheider's the fucking man. He is amazing in everything he's in.
Yeah, never a bad performance.
No.
And
Yeah.
cleverly, it's his performances are memorable and excellent, but not showy. They don't announce themselves. And
No.
again, going back to my earlier strained metaphor, Dustin Hoffman wants you to know how good he is. Roy Scheider
Yeah.
doesn't have that need.
No, not at all. Roy Scheider is in the Gene Hackman school of
Yes,
acting.
another great example. And Hackman played heroes and villains.
I mean, look at the French Connection. There's no bigger bastard of a cop than Popeye Doyle. And Roy Scheider is slightly more sympathetic in that movie just because he's not Popeye Doyle. It's like, well, this guy's nicer by virtue of the fact that he's not Gene Hackman. Hackman is one of the few other actors I could see playing Quint, as long as we took away the brogue.
It would be a different film, but
Yeah.
no, I could easily see him playing that part.
He's a little probably too young because he's closer to Richard Dreyfuss and Roy Scheider in age. And I like the fact that Quint is older and more seasoned and saltier. I don't know. I don't know what else to say about Jaws because it fucking rules. Except I will say this. I've only ever seen Jaws 3. I've never seen 2. I've never seen 4. And think about it. If there's a franchise or a movie that you really like, it makes sense that you would pursue seeing the sequels. I've had my entire life to see the Jaws sequels, and I've never made it a point to do it.
Okay, three on
It's just
is
3 and 4.
points.
Yeah.
Is four the revenge?
Correct.
Okay, I thought there was four and then the revenge was five.
No.
Two is interesting given that you have a film that should never have had a sequel. And I believe the director's name is Jeannot Swark. And it's interesting.
Okay.
It's not a complete success by any means. It certainly head and shoulders above three and four. It's something one should see eventually. But no, we were talking about this last week that there are films that should never have had sequels, that it should have been one and done.
Well, again, Jurassic Park being a great example, Ghostbusters being another one, where it's like we have this idea, we execute it perfectly. Every subsequent movie is, yeah, but what if again? And that's kind of the Jaws phenomenon, right? To the extent that
Oh,
Jaws
yeah.
3 moves the action to fucking SeaWorld, much the way that Jurassic World moves the action to an open theme park.
And that's just the studio saying, we got to sell the soup.
Right,
We put
right.
all this money into the soup, and now we found the soup that people like. That we're once again reminded it's a consumer product. Speaking of consumer products, if you're listening to this podcast and you love Jaws, may I suggest the following? Many versions of Jaws on physical media contain the documentary The Shark Is Still Working, which is very much worth your while, and an earlier making of that was originally on the Laserdisc, which is called The Making of Jaws. And then someone got mad because the first time it was on DVD, it was cut down because the Laserdisc version was endless. And I believe that's been restored to its former length. Carl Gottlieb, who co-wrote the screenplay, published one of the first really popular making of books. It's called The Jaws Log, and you can currently buy it on Amazon for only $11 because no one reads anymore. And that's certainly worth your time because he was there, he wrote it, and he's in the film. And as I've mentioned before, the BFI monograph on Jaws by Antonia Quirk will only set you back $16 on Amazon. Some of those out of print BFI books go for a lot of money, but I still remember reading the Quirk book for the first time and being amazed at the level of detail she was pointing out. I've talked about this before on the podcast. It was Quirk who noticed that Murray Hamilton, the mayor, seems to be trying to quit smoking through the first 20 minutes of the film, but the last time we see him, he's lit up and he's in a hospital. And Miss Quirk suggests that the mayor is not going to a good place anytime soon. That the BFI monograph of Jaws is sort of amazing. And just like you said at the beginning of our podcast, so much has been written about this film and said about this film that it's amazing that Quirk manages to come up with a book full of really interesting insights.
And I love that shit because the fact that you can even write a book of insights about Jaws, not just one, but many books, as you pointed out, like, it's kind of a miracle because I think the cultural memory of Jaws, even though it is a well-respected and beloved film, is what I said earlier, that it was this, it invented the summer blockbuster, it killed the sort of political, personal film of the 1970s. And its cultural memory is kind of what you see is what you get. It's a fun ride, but there's a lot more to it than that.
And that's not true
Right.
because you don't, I'm not stretching here. Jaws is a political film in that better minds than mine have pointed out that Murray Hamilton is Nixon.
Right. Right. I just started reading. Oh, shoot. What's it called? The Death of the Unicorn?
The Mammoth Book.
No, that's something else.
I believe there's a unicorn in that title
I'm
too.
on a Peter Bogdanovich kick for an article that I'm writing, and he wrote this
Oh,
book
the Dorothy Stratton book.
about the murder of Dorothy Stratton, and I'm 20 pages in, and I'm like, I don't know if I can continue this because this is very fucking sad.
He led a life. I was sort of amazed at how much pro movie stuff he did at the end of his life. He did that podcast with Ben Mankiewicz, and he finished two books, one about directors, one about actors. They're both really, really good. Because people tend to forget before he made The Last Picture Show, he was a film critic. He was a writer about film. And man, what a career he had. Although I recently saw Nickelodeon.
Yeah.
Boy, that movie doesn't work.
It does not. It comes from an interesting period in the 70s. He made a couple in a row that are flawed.
Yeah. But I thought you were going to say Last Picture Show, Paper Moon, What's Up, Doc? It's a pretty impressive
And Targets before
list.
those, and I think Targets kind of rules.
Yeah, I tend to forget Targets. Targets is terrific and
Yeah.
has Karloff.
Last thing, Targets comes from Roger Corman. Bogdanovich is working for Roger Corman. Roger Corman's famous quote is that Jaws was going to put him out of business because now the studios had figured out how to make Roger Corman movies.
I
Of
love
course not.
Roger,
Yeah,
but
it's.
I don't agree.
Jaws is much more than a Roger Corman movie, but it does give birth to the Roger Corman take on Jaws, which is Joe Dante's Piranha, which is also a wonderful film.
It's delightful. It ain't Jaws.
No, of course not. It knows that it isn't Jaws because it opens with somebody playing a Jaws video game just to acknowledge, like, yes, we know we're not Jaws.
Yes, and in many of the shots, the piranha fish look like the shadows of Pepperidge Farm goldfish crackers.
Thanks for talking Jaws with me, J Bones.
No problem. It was really great to see you guys last weekend.
Yes, it was.
And I'm very much looking forward to the end of July. Fingers crossed.
Yeah,
Fingers
mine
crossed.
too. Mine too. And we'll have to hit up the New Beverly again when we're there because every time I go, I run into famous directors.
And as Erica pointed out, because I think you've had two of these so far, and God knows I've only had one, so you're one ahead of me, that you are in a public place and someone recognizes your voice from the podcast.
Yes. Oh, I should give a shout out to our friend who was sitting in the row in front of us who turned around and said, "Are you Patrick Bromley?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "I love F this movie. Your voice is in my head. I recognized it because your voice is in my head all the time." And I was very, very appreciative and flattered by that. So thank you. And we spent the rest of the night talking to him and predicting what the next movie was going to be. And it was great.
And there is nothing better, and there's nothing that makes me not want to be famous more.
Go to fthismovie.com every day for cool movie shit. Read JB's column, Johnny Deadline, every Tuesday. New podcast every Wednesday. Reserve seating on youtube.com/fthismovie every Thursday. Email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. And we're on all the social medias at fthismovie. Thanks again, JB.
You're going to need a bigger pot.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.